In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 90 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston. 90 episodes, Liz. Can you imagine that? That's amazing.
Not 90. I feel about 90, Helen. I don't know about you,
but
goodness gracious, life is full on at the moment, is it not?
It's amazing. And you've had a really interesting sort of, well, a very quick but very interesting few days elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's work hard, play hard at the moment. Play hard. I've just been across for the running of the bulls in Pamplona and got the opportunity to meet up again with Fran and his family, and also for the first time in almost 3 years, Jorge, which was just absolutely fantastic. So the Scottish bloops, the Scottish blethers and the Spanish loops coming together. But it's Fran's, because he lives in Pamplona, one of his major roles is organising balconies for the running of the bulls. So at very short notice, he invited Brian and myself over because he had spare room on one of his balconies for both the San Fermín Festival, which is the first day, the opening of all of this week-long celebration, and then the second day, another balcony, which actually overlooked the route that the bulls run through. Now, tomorrow's episode is about the 12th of July, the marching season, highly controversial in Scotland, when those that support William of Orange in the Battle of the Boyne and see him as the protector of the Protestant culture celebrate. And some would see this as sectarianism. It's certainly controversial, but it is part of some people's culture. They hold it very dear. And I must confess that that was much how I felt about the running of the bulls. Fran and I had a discussion about this in a previous episode. I don't get it, and I don't get it even more after having come back and seen it. I mean, I wanted to even it up and trip a few of the runners up so the bulls had a fair chance, I must confess. But no, I don't get that side of it. But What I do get is this absolute celebration of culture, which was just phenomenal. So a phenomenal few days, Helen.
Oh, that's great. Well, I haven't done very much, Liz. I haven't done anything controversial. I've led a very busy life, but nothing controversial.
You're all about the guiding, and I'm
all
back
about
on
the guiding.
Back on again tomorrow.
Oh, you
I have
are, yes.
Driver guiding. Ooh, driver guiding terrifies me. I can talk all day, but finding my way from A to B is quite a challenge. So I may have something to report back on that. But the poor woman who has hired me for the next few days, I hope that everything goes smoothly.
It will go smooth. It will go smoothly, Liz. And just remember, post-it notes all over the dashboard. Oh, and once you've done that road or that turn, take it off and put it on the floor.
Oh, I'm afraid that's too complicated for me, Helen. Got to keep my eyes on the road to look for the signposts and whatever. So, no, I've done the route several times. I'm well organised, so I hope I just don't go off-piste and then we'll all be okay. So this route takes me through one that you're very familiar with, which is through Forfar and Angus, and this lady is very much into her royalty and royal palaces and castles. So that's the theme over the next few days as we travel about around Scotland. And I think it's an area you know well.
Yes, yes, that area. My family came from up that area. You had sort of migrated down from there towards Dundee. So yes, it's a lovely area.
So we decided to narrow it down a little bit to a place that's dear to both of us, which is Kirriemuir.
Yes, and Kirry, or as it's known often as Kirry, or the wee red toonie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, of course, the wee red toonie, the red comes from the colour of the stone. And when you're driving through that area of Perthshire, it is so predominant, this very deep red, that the sandstone that the buildings are made of, it's just beautiful.
Yes, this old red sandstone that forms the bedrock, and it certainly defines the town of Kirry. And you know, we tend to think of it as a relatively rural agricultural area these days, but it was right at the heartland of the Picts, the Picti, the painted people.
Yeah, and it was a centre of the, you know, of ecclesiastical importance as well, and that can be seen by the number of sculptured stones or Pictish stones that can be found there, and mostly now have been sort of rescued and put into the museums. But it is just really ancient history there.
It is. And we're talking about red stones, red sandstones, but every so often at some of the older houses, you'll see a completely different stone. It's hard, grey, and set against the local red sandstone. And that's a witch's stain. And it's said that it was put there to ward off evil.
Yeah, and you can understand that because, you know, at that time, Liz, you know, right throughout Scotland, and I'm sure many other cultures, it was very important to just keep the witches at bay, hence the rowan tree in my garden.
Yep, and on the outskirts of the town, there's a pool that's known as the Witch Pool, because, of course, if anyone was accused of witchcraft in those days, they gave them a very fair trial. They put them on a duking stool, they tied their thumb to their big toe, they chucked them into the water. If they sank, then they were innocent and they'd get their reward in heaven. If they were guilty, they floated up to the top and they'd take them and burn them at the stake. That's what you call a lose-lose situation.
I'm going to say, Liz, I think that's what they call it now in business terms, isn't it? A lose-lose situation. But of course, that witch's pool was part of the Meikle Mill. It was, I think it was a mill pond, which again goes to back to some of the agriculture, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, I mean, they think Meikle is a good Scottish word meaning large. So a large mill, we've got a saying, many a Meikle makes a muckle. Sorry, that's a small, sorry, because it's many a Meikle makes a muckle.
That's right.
So lots of small pennies make a pound. But in this case, it was actually the man who built the mill was called Meikle, John Meikle.
So, and of course, that all goes back, the fact that they had mills, etc., goes back to when it was created a borough. You know, Kirriemuir was created a borough by James II back in the 1400s. And that charter of, you know, becoming a borough allowed the people there to hold weekly markets and annual fairs. So again, culture and tradition was beginning back in the mid-1400s.
Yes, we travel around Scotland with guests who come to visit and they become very familiar with this term borough because it's just really the first settlements. And as you say, Helen, the land was feud and they could build houses on it. But also at the same time, they were able to have a market. And this was really important because this was where goods could be sold and this was the start of trade. And who they paid the tolls when they came to sell their goods to determined what kind of borough it was.
Yes, because and this was, it was funny, it was even the spelling of Kerrymuir, Kerrymuire, because of course things are written down word of mouth, aren't they? What somebody hears, they write down.
Yeah, and that was why all the names were all different as well. The spelling of the names right up until relatively recent times was just dependent on how the registrar wrote it down or how it was written down in the parish registrar. But this was the sort of highest ranking borough, if you like, because this paid its taxes to the king. So it was a royal borough.
Yes, and of course it was James V. One of the names that is associated with Kirriemuir is, it's a very strange name. Well, it was the Robert Lauder, and he was actually granted the borough as part of this, you've done a good thing, so here's some land you can have, by James V. So it goes back to there, this granting of land. But I think even in that time, James V's daughter, Mary Queen of Scots, it is said that, well, the Privy Council records record that this Robert Lauder of the Bass, which was the name of the person who was given the land by James V, he loaned £2,000 to Mary Queen of Scots and Henry Lord Darnley. And it is said that that loan was never repaid. And they were chased up for it. But then eventually the loan was had been underwritten by somebody else and they chased them. But then it all finished, fizzled out, Liz, just a damp squib, because everybody kept dying and nobody else had hoped me. Can't be me. So it just disappeared.
I mean, if somebody could find that bill of debt to Mary Queen of Scots, they'd be worth a fortune these days.
Can you imagine what £2,000 in the 1500s, what that would be worth nowadays?
Absolutely.
Oh, could do with that.
But I suppose that the wealth of Kirriemuir really was built on the linen and jute industry.
Yes,
because, you know, as you travel through the lands of Forfar and Angus these days, very, very rich agricultural land because of all of the boulder clay that was left behind when the glaciers were there. So it's very rich soil. But in days gone by, the major crop that was grown was flax for linen making.
Yeah. And linen was just so important to you everywhere. Right around not just Angus, but into Fife and everything was that linen. But one of the things that Kirriemuir managed to kind of find a specialism in was a special type of material, which I'm so glad that fashion has changed, Liz. This was for making corsets. This material made very corsets, which were strong enough to pull in with the laces. Remember these? We've seen so many cartoons of women having their shape changed by corsets and laces.
In the 1760s, a local weaver found that he could make a double thickness of linen and that it was ideal for these foundations. So by 1860, 100 years later, there were 1,500 weavers in Kirriemuir. And of course, at this time, before in this 100 years at the start in the 1760s, most people would have been handloom weavers, whereas at the end of that 100 years, they would have moved into factories with the coming of the steam power.
Yeah, and you even when I think there were 9 million yards of linen per year, you can't even get that into your head, can you? You can't even visualise that, what that would look like.
That's a lot of corsets, a lot of weight being held in there. But thankfully, around about World War One, this foundation idea of the laced-up corsets died a death.
Oh, thank goodness.
But it also brought an end to 150 years of prosperity for Kirriemuir's weaving industry. But I think I heave a sigh of relief these days that I don't have to hold everything in.
But they also, Kirriemuir is quite close to Dundee, which was the centre of jute weaving and manufacture. And Kirriemuir had quite a buoyant jute industry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the Verdant Mill there today that you can go and see, I mean, it had not only the flax to start off the linen, but then it was able to import the jute fibres and most importantly, the whale oil to make them soft so that they could actually weave them into the burlap or canvas that was in such demand at that time.
Yes, and in Kirriemuir, there's still the name of J&D Wilkie's factory is still a name in Kirriemuir, although it's kind of not slightly off from its former self, but it's still there, still trying to keep linen and jute alive.
Yeah, and one of the other claims to fame that Kirriemuir has is that it's got the narrowest close or street in the UK. It's just over 15 inches wide. So maybe we would need our corsets to be able to get through that one. That's called Cat's Close.
It sounds like the two go hand in hand. Maybe, now, which was it? You know, chicken and egg situation. What was the close there? So I said, oh, we need to slim these women down to get through there. Or did the slim the women down and say, oh, well, we can narrow the streets.
Yeah, it's interesting, Helen, that it was the women that had to wear the corsets.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Although I think the men did as well in those days, but they've gone nowadays. Yes. But talk about men, another very important man that we discuss a lot as we travel around Scotland was Sir Hugh Munro.
Yes, yes. Now, we're always talking about Munros when we're talking about mountains, and that's from Sir Hugh Munro, whose family sort of estate was very close to Kirriemuir.
Yep, and he was the first to actually catalogue all the mountains over 3,000 feet in elevation in Scotland. And so that's why any mountain that's over 3,000 feet today is called a Munro. And we have people who are called Munro baggers who go around and they collect them, climb into the top of them.
Yeah, and I understand to be a true Monroe bagger, you have to actually start each Monroe from the bottom. And some ranges, you can top off several Monroes by just nipping across the top of the mountain. But to be a true Monroe bagger, you must go up one peak, then come down to the bottom, and then go up the next peak, rather than just hop across the top.
Well, maybe if you did all of that and you did all of these Monroes, you probably wouldn't need the corsets. You'd be
probably not.
You know, there'd be as much.
That's right.
You know, there's not much meat in a butcher's dog. You know, as fit as a flea.
Yeah, mind you, Liz, I have to say that now we're kind of halfway through the season. I feel that I can get up and down to Edinburgh Castle and you'll do all these walking tours so much easier now than I did when I first started after the 2 year layoff over COVID. It's just great.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the advantages of it. And talking about walking, Helen, I mean, when you're in Kirriemuir, you're right at the heart of the Angus Glens and some of the most attractive hill walking in Scotland with Monroes. And you've actually even got a museum in Kirriemuir that tells you all about these glens round about.
Yes, and I think because Kirriemuir and these glens are so accessible to, like, the city of Dundee and, you know, even Aberdeen, that they're very, very popular for, you know, the East Coast towns, whereas, you know, over in the West there's different ones. But yeah, they're lovely.
Yes.
But talking about mountains, Liz, in Greenland, apparently in 1961, one of the mountains there was named Kirriemuir. And that mountain is nearly 7,000 feet high. So we don't even have anything coming near that in Scotland, but we've got a Kirriemuir in Greenland.
Well, that certainly is a mountain. It took you your time to climb to the top of that. I think the name Kirriemuir, I'm pretty sure that there's a Kirriemuir somewhere in the United States as well. You know, all these people who went off the great diaspora of Scotland and started up places and called them after their hometown of Kirriemuir. So we talked about Sir Hugh Monroe as being a famous son of it. Another famous son of Kirriemuir is Sir David Wilkie. Now, that's not David Wilkie, the Scottish swimmer. This goes much further back to 1882. And if you go round the art galleries of Scotland, you'll come across paintings by Sir David Wilkie. He was one of the most famous artists of the 19th century. And I have a link to that through my husband, because when he did his genealogy, it's likely that they are actually distantly related.
Oh, really?
So Sir David Wilkie, he was from Kirriemuir as well.
And he actually is probably quite like Brian, because David Wilkie used to paint just as he saw it. And I think Brian says it just as he sees it.
So that's
a good link.
Yeah, I think maybe Sir David Wilkie had a little bit more talent.
Poor Brian.
Brian. Yeah, no, he was from the town. He's also, there's also a statue to a much more contemporary child of Kirriemuir, and that is the lead singer and lyricist of AC/DC.
Yes, Bon Scott lived there as a child in Kirriemuir, presumably before they moved over to Australia.
Yep. But when you talk about Kirriemuir, there's no doubt about it. Word association with Kirriemuir, the person you think of most, J.M. Barrie.
Yes, J.M. Barrie, for those that don't instantly recognise the name, Peter Pan might be more sort of familiar to you.
Yeah, and if you go to Kirriemuir these days, you can actually visit his birthplace, which is at 9 Brechin Road. It's now owned by the National Trust for Scotland, and they present it as a museum where they've actually taken his home and they've converted the kitchen and the bedroom to an upstairs museum where you can actually see how he would have lived with his family there. They've even got his own writing desk. So it's just, as you could imagine, J.M. Barrie with his family.
Yes, and it was a huge family that lived in that house, though, wasn't it? Wasn't he one of about 6 or 8 or 10?
He was 10. He was the ninth child out of 10. But it was a relatively middle-class family. His father was a weaver, which most of the people of Kirriemuir would have been at that time. But they were a very staunch, conservative, Calvinist family, very Presbyterian. So it was a very, very strict upbringing. And his mother, had to take over responsibility for running her family home at the age of 8 when her mother died. So she was a quite austere, very, very strong influence on J.M. Barrie's life.
Yes, and if you cast your eye around, you know, today's families and look at 8-year-olds, you think, gosh, that must have been dreadful for his mother. And, you know, that also had an influence on her relationship with her own children, that, you know, she had this austere and difficult, well, almost no childhood. When she suddenly aged 8, she had to become an adult. But J.M. Barrie himself, he really didn't grow very tall. He was only about 5'3½", 4 inches, which is, you know, not a tall person.
No, he was a poor wee soul, I think we would call him.
Oh, yes.
A poor wee soul. But what he lacked in physical stature, he made up in being able to entertain people. He loved to tell stories. And tragedy struck the family when he was just 6 years old. He was the 9th out of 10 children, but one of his elder brothers was called David, and he was their mother's favourite. And tragedy struck when he died in an ice skating accident just the day before his 14th birthday, and his mother was absolutely devastated.
Yes, and I think poor J.M. Barrie tried very hard to endear himself to his mother, and you'll say, look, you know, I'm still here.
He used to dress up in his brother David's clothing and walk around the house whistling the way that David did, so that his mother felt as if David was still there. But the one thing that she did get comfort in was the fact that her dead son would remain a boy forever. He wouldn't grow up and leave her. And that became a fixation in we call him J.M. Barrie. He was James to his mother. Jimmy was his name, but he wrote under the name J.M. Barrie.
Yes, and... But even he went away to school at a very early age. Age 8, he went to Glasgow, but two of his older siblings were already there. They was kind of in their care when he was at school there. But then he came back to go to secondary school in Kirriemuir.
Yep, and from there he went on to Dumfries Academy at the age of 14. And if you visit Dumfries these days, there's another National Trust property at Moatbury House. And the garden of that was said to be the inspiration for the Enchanted Neverland, which was to be the setting for Peter Pan.
Because they used to play pirates there, didn't they? Just, you know, it all comes together, doesn't it, when you're looking at it, how you all these things that were happening in his life were all coming together to create that wonderful story of Peter Pan.
Yeah, he even acted it out in the washroom. You can visit the wash house at this birthplace museum and see where, you know, the whole of the street would have come there to do their washing. And he would have entertained them, telling them stories and acting out plays. And you can imagine him running through the gardens of the moat house at Dumfries. It was said that with his pals, they would go there and play pirates. And he made the famous quote, "When shades of night began to fall, certain young mathematicians shed their triangles and crept up trees and down walls in an odyssey which was long after to become the play of Peter Pan."
Oh, yes, yes.
Not my words, Helen, his words. He had a way with the words.
Oh, Liz, you've given it away. I was going to give you the credit. But the storytelling came from his mother, because that's how the two of them kind of began to bond, was through her telling him stories about, you know, her upbringing and the village of, or it was the village of Kirriemuir where they were living. And he then wove all that into some short stories, which then became, and he called the village Thrums, the window in Thrums.
Yeah, he went off to university, and his father and his the elder siblings all wanted them to have a profession. And the idea was that he'd become a minister, but he was not for that. He always wanted to become an author. And so the compromise was that he would go to Edinburgh University and he would study literature. And so he did that. And when he graduated, he got a job writing for one of the local newspapers. And he started to write these stories, as you say, that his mother had told him. And they began to get published. And eventually ended up developing into a series, which wasn't critically acclaimed by all. But they were very popular with a number of people. The critics thought it was a bit what was called the Kale Yard School. It was a bit old-fashioned and sentimental and nostalgic, whereas, you know, Scotland was changing. It was industrialised by the 19th century. But it was enough to establish him as a successful writer.
Yes, but his literary career, even after that, had a few ups and downs, didn't it? Not everything he did was sort of welcomed with open arms. You know, quite a few of his stuff just literally died a death before it had even sort of risen off the page.
Yeah, it was the sentimentalism and this obsession with never growing old, never growing beyond. I mean, the resonance with Michael Jackson is enormous.
Oh, huge, isn't it?
Because, I mean, Michael Jackson created Neverland, as Barry did, and this obsession with never growing old, always remaining a child. And although he married, it said that that marriage was never consummated. And, you know, the same suspicions, you know, accusations that Michael Jackson faced as well. But in the case of J.M. Barrie, there was never any foundation found for any speculation. It just purely, I think he was just a childlike character that never grew up himself.
Yes, and he had, again, when you look at the number of friends that he had in the literary world, big, big names in the literary world were part of his set, whether it was sort of by writing to them or just by being with them. People like H.G. Wells, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. He even had quite a long correspondence with Robert Louis Stevenson, although they never met.
Yeah, he was invited to go and visit him in Samoa, where Robert Louis Stevenson was working at this time. But it wasn't just the literary set. He also, you know, anybody who was anybody in those days was a friend. For example, Joseph Thomson, who was an explorer in Africa, and perhaps even more famous, Robert Falcon Scott, who was the Antarctica explorer.
Yes, and interesting, because of course the ship Discovery's in Dundee, very close to Kirriemuir now. But James Barrie, was he godfather to Peter Scott, Captain Scott's son?
Yeah, one of the seven people that Scott wrote to in his dying hours on his expedition to the South Pole, one of the people he wrote to was James Barrie, and he asked him if he would look after and take care of his wife Kathleen and son Peter. And Barrie was so proud of this that he actually carried the letter around with him for the rest of his life.
Yes, I mean, well, what an honour. Yes,
it was.
But he was you know, a strange man, and he befriended the Llewellyn Davis family by just, he met them in the park, didn't he? The nanny pushing the pram and the little boys running around. He met them when he was walking his dog, his St. Bernard dog. And it all coming together, Liz, think of Peter Pan. J.M. Barrie had the St. Bernard dog, but it's a big old English sheepdog that's usually depicted in Peter Pan. But it's certainly, and even the name Wendy was something that, you came or sort of began during the J.M. Barrie period.
Yep, it was the invention of the name, really, because it came about because Barrie had a friend, a young friend, who couldn't say Fwendy. She called him her friend, her Fwendy, and she couldn't say friend, so she said Fwend, and she became Fwendy. So that's where the name Wendy came from. And he, as you say, we met these children in the park, and also even our own Queen Elizabeth II and her sister Margaret told stories to them, and they claimed him as their friend. He seemed to have this charming way with children where he could tell stories and he could also wiggle his ears, which was another great talent which was attractive for children.
That's right, because Princess Margaret, sort of when she was three, when she met him, she announced, "He is my greatest friend, and he is my greatest friend, and I am his greatest friend." That's just lovely.
He seems to have been a lovely person, but not lucky in love. He married this young, attractive actress, and it was definitely a love match. I mean, she cared for him when he was very ill before they married, and they were together for many years. But eventually she was to have an affair with Gilbert Cannon, who was 20 years younger than she was. And of course, it broke Barrie's heart, and he offered her a legal separation if she would agree not to see Cannon anymore. But she refused, and so they were divorced until his dying day. He, even in his will, he left financial settlement, and he looked after her and Cannon all through their lives.
That's right.
What was touching was that he would give her annual allowance every year at a private dinner that was held on their wedding anniversary. How sad is that?
You just want to cry, don't you? It's just so sad.
You feel sorry
for him. And then not only that, but he suffered the bereavements of the Llewellyn Davis family. You know, these boys that he met and he was, you know, playing with and, you know, writing Peter Pan for. A number of them sort of came to very sort of sudden and very early deaths.
Tragic deaths.
Yes.
Yep, two of the ones that were closest to him. George was killed in action, and Michael drowned with his friend while he was at Oxford University. So yes, a tragic, tragic life. But he does have this legacy, which is Peter Pan. And the Peter Pan that we have today is quite different from the Peter Pan that Barry envisaged. I mean, in it, Peter Pan was the villain.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And well, he's not now, not the one that we have, is he?
No, it's the one that we know. It's Captain Hook. And Captain Hook was only brought into the stage play as a distraction while they changed the scenery behind. And nowadays, you know, some of the strongest images of the Peter Pan we know are Captain Hook and also the crocodile. Yes. With the tick-tock, tick-tock. And if you go to visit the museum and you go out into the garden behind, there's a beautiful sculpture which has got the ticking crocodile.
Yes, I mean, it's lovely. I'm just thinking that Captain Hook really did come into it. He's even had a film all to himself, hasn't he, Hook?
Yeah. So we've tended to see Peter in a good light. But this was one of the features of a lot of Barry's writing, is that, you know, you can dismiss it as sort of whimsical children's writing. But actually, most of it had strong moral tales behind it. It had more clout to it than we give him credit for.
Yes, because there's one of the well-known authors sort of said, yes, it's a story for children, but must be read by adults as well. It's a bit like pantomime, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly it, for the whole family. And of course, one of the other things to finish with that he left Kerrymuir was that with all these friends that he accumulated, he set up a cricket club for people of limited ability, as he was. And so he established a cricket pavilion in Kerrymuir. And nowadays, that's a camera obscura.
Yes, and it's, you know, it's, I think it's lovely because I'm just thinking of Alexander McCall Smith, the author who created the really terrible orchestra because it was for people with limited musical ability. But I think by my standards, they've got very great musical ability.
Yes, so we've got limited musical ability and limited cricketing ability, so from two writers.
But the camera obscura is a lovely thing. And from there, you can get lovely views all over the Kerrymuir, the sort of things that James Barry would really have known and appreciated. He could just go to the cricket pavilion and see these lovely views.
And of course, he's now buried on that hill above Kerry, a lovely simple grave with his parents and some of his siblings. Yeah. And you can go and visit it and walk around. You've got the war memorial there. And there's also a children's play park, which is called Neverland, Peter Pan Land. And you can imagine some of the things that you've got in the play park there.
Yes, and if you do go to have a wee walk around there, why not take some Kerrymuir gingerbread with you for your picnic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the specialities.
Yes, created in Kerrymuir, the gingerbread apparently was a baker named Walter Burnett who got the recipe from a tramp, just somebody passing through, got the recipe, created the gingerbread, and it sold like hotcakes, as they say. But then he made his fortune because he sold the recipe to another baker, and it is now Bells of Shotts and near Glasgow that create or make the Kerrymuir gingerbread, which I love, Liz. I love it.
I do as well, Helen, but you've got to have the butter spread on it so thick that you can see your teeth marks when you bite it.
but that's part of it, isn't it? You cut a nice thick slice and that really thick butter, as you say, the dentist could take an impression.
But if you fancy something savoury before the sweet Kerrymuir gingerbread, you might have a wee Forfar Bridie or a Dundee Pay.
Oh, a pay, that's right, a pay.
Well, talking of food, I think it's time to wind up. So have you got a word of the week?
Well, I was just thinking, we were talking about all the, you know, the days in the early 1900s and the agricultural landscape around Kerrymuir, and what J.M. Barrie would see would be lots of stooks in the field when they were cutting the cereal crops, cutting the corn. They would just put it into little bundles and stand it up, little stooks of the corn in the field.
Well, my word sits nicely alongside your stooks, because my word is styes. Because the good old-fashioned term for a set of corsets was your styes. Your stays. Yes. So right. My grandma always had her Stizer corsets.
Oh, she'd
put a roll on. It was quite an act, actually. I can remember as a child lying in bed in the morning watching her putting her corsets on. And they all had to be rolled on. It was roll-ons. Yeah. Very, very strong foundations there.
Oh, and the whalebones were in there too.
Yeah, I think after too much curry mountaineers, gingerbread and Forfar Bridies, I think I might be going back to the Stays.
No, just keep walking. Just keep walking. Well, that's Kirriemuir. We've certainly covered the ground with Kirriemuir, and looking forward to another week or fortnight out there on the road, Liz. Anything exciting planned?
Literally on the road.
Yes,
so I will report back next week. Right.
We'll
report back. Okay. Yes. Lovely to talk to you, Helen.
Nice to speak to you, Liz.
And bye for now.
Bye for everybody. Bye.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the moo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.